Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast and have a great day.
Thank you very much, and good evening, everybody. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Rick. Richard Leroy Hader is what they named me when I was born. The only reason I say that is because there's a Richard Lynn and a Richard Dominic. So, you know, I'm thrilled to be here. Welcome to everybody. Thank you for coming out tonight. I kind of hit my knees back in the bathroom a moment ago, and I asked God just to give me the strength to tell the truth about myself. Because of my unaided strength, I tend to embellish a little bit, and I promise to spit out some large chunks of truth about myself tonight, and be honest with you. And in doing so, I hope that just one heart gets touched in here, or one mind gets changed. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, or newer to Alcoholics Anonymous, or coming back, I really, really want to welcome you, and I hope that if there's anything I could do to take any contempt prior to investigation away from you about a loving, merciful God, I wish that I could do that. If there's something I could help explain to you about the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts of our program that have given me a life that I didn't ever think was possible, I'd love to do that too. I'd like to tell you that I have a sobriety date, and that's June 25th, 1991. I have a home group. I'm a member of the West Portland group, and I believe that's the best home group in the entire universe. And if you don't feel that way about your home group, there's something wrong with your home group. You better come to the West Portland group and join us. Several of you here have been there. For those of you that haven't, we meet three times a week. We meet Tuesday night in a meeting very similar to this, and that meeting is at the Greater Portland Bible Church on Southwest Vermont Street. It's about 32 minutes from here. And you're all welcome to come and join us. It starts at 7 o'clock, goes to about 8:15. We meet Friday night at 6:30 to 7:30 for a book study, and we have a enormous speaker meeting that's very well attended, and that is Saturday night at 7:30, and your best bet is to get there about 7:15 to get a seat. I've had three home groups. My first home group was the Nightsiders, East Side, Portland, right up here at the Grotto. There's a few people sitting in here tonight that saw me when I first came in there. They said I did some things I don't remember doing, but that's not unusual to a person new in sobriety. I shortly thereafter moved to Tualatin and became a home group member of a group called How It Works. Shortly thereafter, I was feeling like I wasn't getting too spiritually fed, and a loving God through a wonderful, loving sponsor led me to what was the beginnings of the West Portland group. That's been my home group ever since. I've had a service commitment ever since I've been here. My sponsor's name is Carl, and I've got his permission to use his last name, or I wouldn't do that. I've had one sponsor prior to him. My first sponsor was Jack. I like to refer to him as the late, great Jack. We fell together completely by accident and fell in love shortly thereafter, and he helped me with a lot of things in my early sobriety. All of those things are important things, but they certainly don't make me important. It's important for me to say those things so that I know that, number one, that I'm responsible for my own recovery, and I need to take certain actions in order to maintain the practice of those spiritual principles in my life today. Like I say, they don't make me important. I'm dressed up wearing some of my very finest clothes here tonight because I have a tremendous respect for those 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts that have made it possible for me to be sober and enjoy a life that, I mean, I really can't. Tonight, as I left my house, I got to grab my wife's little face in my hands and kiss little Jenny goodbye and tell her I loved her. We weren't doing that 16 years ago. I can guarantee you. So with that, I'm going to get into a little bit about what it was like, what has happened to change me, and what I'm trying to be like today, what things are like for me right now. In the course of doing that, I may talk a little bit about the steps, and I might also talk about some problems in sobriety. A lot of times we hear from a lot of speakers that, you know, we're no longer dull, boring, and glum, and life is wonderful, but I've had some tremendous challenges in the course of the last 16 years, 15 and a half years of sobriety, and thanks to that loving God, I've been able to maintain that sobriety, and with the help of a wonderful sponsor. I was born on October 14th in 1952 in San Jose, California. And what I did with booze, I have no idea, because my mother was Welsh and Irish and my father was 100% pure Cherokee Indian. Those are two ethnic disabilities around alcohol, or they can be. They don't make me alcoholic. I know a lot of Irish and Welsh guys that aren't alcoholic, and I know a lot of Cherokee Indians that aren't alcoholic. But it definitely affected my personality, and I know a lot of people from those ethnic groups that definitely are alcoholic. We see a lot of Irish Catholics around here. Religiously, I was a Southern Baptist, Lutheran, Mormon, Episcopal, Catholic. I've been through all those denominations, and my willingness to find God in the course of those actions was very limited. I didn't find God till I got beat up desperately to cry out for help in Alcoholics Anonymous. As a youngster, I was born 6 weeks premature. My lungs didn't fully develop, so I was born with asthmatic bronchitis, and I coughed and wheezed a lot and could not sleep at night. And what those people that gave birth to me and reared me at a very early age did is they put a little bit of vodka in a tablespoon. They'd heat it up on the stove, and they'd give that to me, and they'd say, "Here, honey, take this. It'll make you feel better." And sometimes they'd put a little drip of honey or a little bit of sugar in there. And that warm vodka, at a very early age, made me feel real good. They were not lying to me when they said, "Take this, it'll make you feel better." Now, that didn't make me alcoholic either, but it gave me an old idea that I carried for a long time, that alcohol, other substances, are gonna make me feel better. And I took that warm vodka, and the cough went away. I could breathe, and I could sleep. And it wasn't long thereafter that I learned to cough on demand. You might hear me coughing here tonight. I've got some peach-flavored water. It reminds me of my old peach schnapps. You know, I didn't really drink peach schnapps, but anyway, that's it. So coughing on demand became a skill real early on to get me that relief. I mean, the ease and comfort that our textbook talks about. Alcohol did for me as I grew up exactly what the fifth step did for me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My fears fell from me when I drank. I was no longer frightened. I had a whole new outlook on life. I could look the world in the eye. I felt great. Without alcohol, I was a nervous little kid. My mother was trying to become a registered nurse, and she had a lot of problems that allowed her to get involved with prescription narcotics, and she left them laying around a lot. And one day when I was about 4 years old, I picked up a couple of these little white tablets that were on her place where she was hanging out watching television all the time. And it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, they heard me run in circles in the living room saying, "Don't touch the coffee table, don't touch the television, don't touch the," you know, and I was nervous and busy and active like that my whole life. I don't remember a lot of my very young childhood. They said that I had a very overactive imagination and I couldn't sit still in school. Today they probably call that ADHD or something like that. They've got labels for it now, but I was a very, very busy kid and I was very nervous and very frightened. And my family moved around quite a bit. My father was in the United States Navy when I was born, and we bumped around quite a bit. We lived in Quonset huts and small places, and when I was about 6 years old, my parents got a divorce, and that had a pretty major effect on me. I had two younger brothers by that time, one that was about 3 years younger than me and one that was 5 years younger than me. My father actually picked us up and took us to his mother's house. That's the Cherokee Indian side of the family. And oddly enough, there was no alcohol even allowed on that property, let alone in the house. My grandfather hailed from Oklahoma, and my father was the oldest boy of 7 children. There were 5 boys and 2 girls in that family, and myself and my 2 younger brothers made it eight boys and two girls. And so a family of 10, my grandfather, who was the leader and the patriarch of that family, was a custodian and kind of a jack of all trades, so we were very poor. But I love that. I love that part of my life because my uncles were my heroes. They were like my older brothers, and my father actually was like my oldest brother. We had our own baseball team. We did a lot of stuff together, even though we had nothing. We had a lot of fun, but my mother, who had had this nervous breakdown when they split up, got married to another guy in Seattle. And they showed up one day without me even knowing they were coming and took my two brothers and myself and dropped us in the back of this car and took us up to Seattle to live with her and her new husband. That kind of freaked me out a little bit because here I left all of that camaraderie and all of that family that I had and was taken to Seattle, and the few little belongings that we had fit in a couple little boxes. We didn't have much, but what we did have meant a lot to us. And one of the first things that happened when I got up there is my stepfather took me into one of the very first Nordstrom stores in the Seattle area and made me buy wingtip and saddle shoes, corduroys with cuffs on them, and shirts with button-down collars, and I absolutely hated it. I had worn-out T-shirts and Levi's that belonged to my older uncles and a pair of PF Flyers that definitely made me run faster and jump higher. I hated surrendering that stuff. And I thought he did that because he hated me, and I couldn't stand that guy for a long, long time. I carried that resentment with me for a very, very, very long time. All that moving around, all that jumping around caused me to believe, I adopted a belief system that my needs are not important. People don't tell me what's going on, they just tell me what to do. And I started to get a little rough around the edges with that. I really didn't like that. One of the things, in addition to giving me those tablespoons of vodka when I was real little, is they'd bring us into the dinner table and give us little water glasses full of beer. And my mom used to tell people it stimulates their appetite. Well, you know, I got pretty hungry after a half an hour of beer drinking when I was 5 years old. They weaned us off the booze. You know, moving in with my stepfather and my mom, the good thing about that is that they drank. And so I found the keys to the liquor cabinet, and I found the keys to the refrigerator, and I got an early morning paper route, and I would steal beer out of that refrigerator, take it with me on my paper route. I actually, you know, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, people were talking about childhood drinking and losing jobs from drinking, and I thought, I never drank when I was a kid that much, and I never lost a job for, wait a minute, I lost my paper route because I was drunk. You know, the kids would show up at the paper shack and say, who's going on your paper route with you today? And I'd say things like, Anheuser. Anheuser's going with us today. Or Schlitz, you know, is going with us. Or Carling, or whatever the beer was, you know, and I thought it was like nobody would know if I referred. We'd get drunk and throw papers all over the place. I mean, I never hit the right addresses. You know, it was a great time to just get down early in the morning. You know, I used to, we would sneak beer into school when I was in middle school and as a young kid, and my folks would have a lot of parties, and we would drink during those parties and drink the leftovers, and I found out that I was extremely, extremely frightened of other people. I didn't want to get to know people that much, but all this moving around had led me to be a real surface guy. So I would show you what I thought you wanted to see to be friends with you, but you never really knew who the hell I was. And I was like a chameleon, and that proved to be a helpful thing to me a little bit later on as I got older and became a salesperson, because I could mirror people real easy and persuade them to buy things from me. That's when I thought I got real powerful. But at a young age, it was not comfortable, and it was very, very hard for me to fit in. So, like I say, alcohol did a lot for me with that. That the fears falling from me and my confidence being all right, and alcohol really did everything for me, and I believe that it would do a lot for me if I tried drinking today. I believe it would take me to an unconscious place and drop me out right where I've never been arrested, I need to tell you that, and I should have been. I mean, I drank and drove every day of my life. When I first got sober, I had to have something cold between my legs when I was driving because I drank all the time while I drove. But the fact that I'd never been arrested seemed to me when I first came to AA like maybe I don't belong here because I've never been to jail. And I had some circumstances that led to me actually take meetings into the Multnomah County Jail right now. And there was a time when I thought I wouldn't be able to do that because I'd never been arrested. Well, talk about alcoholism, alcoholics start nodding their heads sometimes. So as I grew older, you know, I ended up in the Navy. I was getting in the very, very, very end of the Vietnam War. It was about 1970. And I found myself in trouble with the draft board, and my father convinced me, instead of running away and going to Canada, that I should join the Navy and see the world and wear those bell-bottom pants and meet all those girls that love the uniforms and have a roof over my head every night and drink like a real sailor. And that last part caught my attention. So, you know, I joined the Navy and I actually went up to Seattle where my mother was living and joined the Navy and off to see the world. Everywhere I went my whole life, I always fell in with you people. There's something about you people that's very attractive to me. I love alcoholics. I love Alcoholics Anonymous today with all my heart, all my mind, all my soul. And I love alcoholics the same way. Even in high school, I went to live with my grandmother in Eugene to go to high school, and they started this thing down there at Sheldon High School in 66, that was, no attendance. We're not going to take attendance anymore. We're not going to give grades. It's open campus, and it's pass and fail, pass or fail. And I thought, great, that's my kind of program. I can drink. I can do whatever I want to do. I can screw around and pass. I mean, anybody can get a D, you know, and I was good at getting Ds. So, drinking was something I always fell in with. I did a lot of other substances. I wasn't a specialist with drinking, but that's where it started, and that's where it always ended. I got to the point where the last 2 years of my Navy enlistment, about the last year and a half, they were taking volunteers to come to Portland, Oregon to train reserves up here. And there was no Navy here at that time. This was about 1974. And I volunteered to come here because I'd had family in Seattle, family in the San Francisco Bay Area, and some family down in Eugene. And when I got up here, I rented a house over in North Portland, right off of Lombard and Greeley, and a buddy of mine called me up one day and said, hey, there's a dance at the University of Portland. There's like four girls for every guy, live music, and 10-cent beers. 10-cent beers got my attention once again, and I went to the dance. And all those girls, it sounded kind of exciting. But when you're really hammered, they're not too hot on dancing with you, I found out. So I came up with a great strategy that I would stand by the restroom, and when one of these girls that caught my eye came to go to use the restroom, I would trip her and then catch her and ask her to dance. And my friend said, I got to see this. That's exactly how I met my wife. She went to use the bathroom. I tripped her, caught her, said, I just cracked your head open. Do you want to dance? And she says, well, I'm going to the restroom right now, you know. She came out, and we did dance. We did, I was like, for me, it was like love at first sight. I absolutely was smitten with her right off the bat. Got her. I memorized her phone number. I was never able to do that in a drunken stupor. And she had come with another couple of friends of hers. There were a couple guys and a girlfriend. These guys were in the Air Force ROTC program at the University of Portland. I remember telling them, the keys are coming to me. She's riding with me. I don't care how you guys get home. I'll give you a ride if you need it. But, you know, we're out of here. And I can remember having all these ulterior motives, rushing down to the store. This was back when they closed the Plaid pantries at 2 in the morning and they wouldn't sell you any beer. And I was there at like 5 after trying to get into the beer case. And we ended up drinking Kool-Aid and sitting on the couch for a minute. And here came my buddy that took me to the dance. He's knocking on the door and I'm trying to tell him, get out of here. And he's like, oh, such a young girl. Anyway, she went home, nothing happened, and but it was the beginning of a real vicious dance between my wife and I. We loved each other. I wanted to get married right away. She said, hey, why don't we wait a year, see if we feel the same way. We partied together. We went all dancing all over town, drinking like crazy, having a wonderful time together. We eventually did get married. I did get out of the Navy. She convinced me to go back to college. We had a wonderful life for a while until she went and got pregnant. Now that is a dangerous thing for a young guy in my situation because women usually want to start taking care of themselves when that happens, and that's exactly what she did. She stopped drinking, started eating healthy, no more going out partying all night, and I thought, man, this is no fun, this pregnant stuff, you know, and I would tell her things like, go ahead and order a couple drinks and I'll drink them. It's okay. And she kind of started looking at me funny then, you know, and we started drifting apart at that point. alcohol started becoming more and more important to me. It got to the point where even after our children were born, alcohol was more important than my family. It was more important than anything to me. It kind of jumped in the front seat of the car, is the way I like to describe it sometimes. It started driving the car, and I was the passenger. And I didn't see it, and I didn't know it, and I didn't want to believe it, and I didn't want to admit it. And it got to the point where our kids were little enough that it was like, it was a lot of work with these kids, and I'm not into working. And it was a lot of responsibility, and that is something I don't want any piece of. And it was a lot of commitment, and that word scared me. And I hated being obedient, and I hated doing things. I mean, I wanted to just go get loaded, and that's all I wanted to do. And if I came home, I wanted them to worship me, fix me food, do whatever I needed them to do, but just leave me the hell alone and don't talk to me about my drinking. And obviously that didn't occur. So eventually I quit coming home. I mean, I'd say, I'm going to go play golf. I love to play golf. I'd go to play golf and I'd never hit the golf course. And it would be like 2 or 3 days later. I'd call for a little while. Oh, well, you know, I'm going to be a little bit late. I'll probably be home by like 8, maybe. And then I'd call back at 10. Well, we're doing something real important here. Next thing you know, it would be the next day or a couple days later, I'd show up. And those receptions when I got home were not what I had really desired or expected. She wasn't real thrilled to see me. And the questions of, where have you been? Are you drunk? You know, they got me a little bit angry. And I started putting my fists through the wall. I started having these huge displays of anger and fierce, manhood for this little girl that's only, 5 feet tall. I even struck my wife. I started hitting my wife, knocking her around, scaring the living hell out of my kids. When I would come home, it was like somebody had lobbed a hand grenade into our living room. They just all scattered, you know. Then the kids would kind of peek around the corner and see if we were going to have a fight or not. And, so life was not looking too hot. And it got to the point where I got an invitation one day to get some help or get the hell out of that house. And that was the turning point for me. I was 37, about 38 years old, and I really had come to that point where I knew the party was over. I knew that I was wondering, do other people feel like I'm feeling? It seems like people are having an awful good time, and I was not having a good time. My normal day would start about 3 o'clock in the morning, waking up in a puddle of my own fluid, wondering where in the hell I was at, shaking uncontrollably, looking for that bottle to kind of calm my nerves a little bit and try and get a little bit more rest, pass out a little bit again if I could, stumble into the shower early in the morning, try and get ready to go to work. I was absolutely incapable of doing anything at work. Once I got in the shower, I turned bright red. I couldn't quit sweating. I started shaking violently. I had to have alcohol in my system around the clock. It was a necessity. It was no longer a hobby. It was no longer in the fun phase. But I wanted to think I was enjoying myself with drinking. I mean, that's the insanity. That's how insane I was about it. And I thought my wife wanted me to stop because she wanted me to quit enjoying myself. And I remember complaining to people, God dang it, it's the one thing I enjoy doing. Did I enjoy that? And when I heard the word alcoholic, I thought, no, I'm not an alcoholic. I've got a job. I've got a car. I'm living in this house. I've got this wife that I haven't spoken to for about 4 years. I've got these kids that run like a hand grenade's been dropped. I'm not an alcoholic. And I ended up, she had made an appointment for me to go see a counselor. And I thought it was a marriage counselor. And it was actually another alcoholic. And he started talking about how he felt when he drank, how he felt during his drinking, and how he felt after his drinking. I got tuned into this guy. And I thought, man, this guy knows what's been going on with me. And I thought, who's been telling him how I feel, and I kind of connected with this guy, and he told me that I had a fatal progressive disease. And I thought, I kind of like that, because up to that point, I had been so ashamed of the things that I had been doing and felt like it was a weakness, a lack of willpower. Something was wrong with me. I was convinced I was out of my mind with insanity. Didn't know what to do about it, but I was willing in that narrow moment to seek some kind of help. I had a real small window of opportunity there. And I had agreed with him, you know, I was like, okay, I got this. What do I do about it? He said, you know, if I'm you, I'm going to St. Vincent Hospital. I'll arrange for you to talk to somebody. They'll get you into a program over there. So my appointment to go to the hospital wasn't for 3 or 4 days after I was talking to him. And I'd thrown away all the paraphernalia, gotten rid of all the booze. You know, I was a little bit frightened. I had a willingness to want to learn about a different way without the booze, but I was really having a tough time without it. And by the 3rd or 4th day, when I started to be able to eat some food and feel a little bit better, I thought, this is a big mistake, going to this hospital. You know, I can't be going over there. I'm feeling pretty good. I really don't have a problem. I haven't drank for 2-3 days now. You know, I can't be alcoholic. Alcoholics have to drink every day. And so I went in there to this interview, and they were asking me a bunch of questions, how I felt. They said I didn't look too good. At that time, I weighed about 250 pounds. My liver was a little distended. It was real tender. My face was as red as a tomato. My eyes were like the chameleon on the Budweiser commercials. I couldn't focus in any one direction, but I felt good, you know, I thought. And they asked me, how much are you drinking? I said, well, you know, I'm drinking about 23.5 ounces a week. And they kind of looked at me and said, 23.5 ounces, how do you? And what I had done is I thought, well, the average guy probably is drinking 2 or 3 beers a day, say 3 beers a day. 6 times 3 is 18. And then maybe 5 beers on a Sunday or a Saturday. So that's like 23. And throw another half in there just for good measure. 23.5. Well, little did I know, the guy that I had gone to talk to was a counselor at that treatment center, and he'd already given him the lowdown on me. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, 23.5. And they said, no, that doesn't sound too bad. But we have a seat for you anyway. Come on in here. So I'm a product of a treatment center, and I'd like to tell you that I was an A student in there, but I wasn't. I wanted to give a Hollywood version of my life history in this little workbook. I can remember sitting down for the first time and hearing a guy tell his experience. We had to read these workbooks to everybody. And I remember asking the guy next to me, God, did you hear that? Why is that guy telling that stuff? You know? And this was a men's group. And I mean, there was some stuff coming out of this guy. And I was like, wow. And the guy next to me said, you know what, if you can't be honest here, and if you can't be honest with yourself and you can't be honest with us, the chance of you having any success with this is very slim. And then he nudged me and he handed me this big pink eraser. And I thought, how in the hell does he know? And he said, here, you might need this. You can start yours over. And I had to erase all my stuff and get going on my workbook again. I'm very grateful for that treatment center for one thing. They directed me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where I found the Nightsiders. I had a friend of mine, Ken Downey, actually, he's no longer with us, and he had come by and 12-stepped me when I was at work one day before I had quit drinking, and he told me his story, and he told me, if I ever wanted to stop drinking and I didn't know how to do it, you know, he told me things like, this morning when I left my house, I gave my wife a kiss goodbye and told her I loved her. And you probably do that. And I remember telling him, well, we're not into that right now. And he said, and you probably can stop at that saloon and have a couple of beers and go home and be a great family man and a wonderful father. And I was like, yeah, probably. And you've got life under, you know, life's manageable, life's under control. And I was like, well, yeah. And I remember telling people, that Ken, he went to college with me, and I remember telling him, that guy is a born-again nut. He's lost it. He's talking about God. He's got this story of all this stuff, and he's freaked out. And people that I would tell that to were looking at me like, yeah, look at you. And so the treatment center that I remember calling Kenny when I got in trouble and saying, you won't believe what happened to me. And he goes, oh, no, I believe what happened to you, you know. And he said, there's a great meeting on the back side of the grotto, and if I'm you, I'd get my rear end up there, and, you know, I'll meet you there. And it starts at noon every day. Get up there about 10 to 12, grab a seat in there, and I'll be in there, and I'll meet you. And I went up there, and I ran to the back of the corner, sat on the couch. There was a couch over there. I sat in the corner of the couch on my hands and just kind of sit there, and people come in and kind of look at me, didn't know who in the hell I was, and I wasn't talking to anybody. And he didn't show up that day. So I sat there, you know, kind of looked around. As soon as the meeting was over, man, I blasted out of there, went back and called him up, and got really mad at him for not showing up. And he said, look, I had some things at work. I'm sorry I didn't get there. I'll be there tomorrow. Meet me there tomorrow, and I'll for sure be there. So the second day I went there and I introduced myself to a couple people. I went back to get a cup of coffee and kind of raised my hand a little bit, and this lady hugged me. And that freaked me out. Well, she's hugging me. And, I ended up sitting down again, and at that meeting I actually laughed. Somebody said something there, and I hadn't laughed in a long time. And I can remember, they're talking along about these things, and I'm kind of relating to something, and then something struck me, and I kind of, I caught myself, and I thought, am I the only one laughing, and people looked at me kind of, oh, he's laughing, and I was really angry because he didn't show up. I left there again, called him back. The third day, he came and picked me up and brought me to the meeting. So I was there 3 days in a row, and I heard some stuff that confused me, and I didn't know a whole lot about it, but I was required to go to 2 meetings a week, so I decided to go on Tuesday and Thursday every week to the grotto. And, that was a great place for me then. I heard a lot of things there that didn't make a lot of sense, and I became a part of that group, and I eventually got a commitment there. I really wanted to belong to something. I wanted to finish something, and I can remember helping clean ashtrays with Melinda and learning how to make coffee, and they even let me make coffee before I actually had 90 days. That was a big thing. I went, oh, God, I get to make coffee, Then somebody actually bought a timer where you didn't have to get there so early, and we could make it the day before, and, you had to make a fire in the wintertime to keep the place warm, and I loved that place. In my first year of sobriety, I was terrified to chair the meeting. Here these people seemed like they were gods to me and my idols, and I had to get up there and try and say something. Freaked me out to do it, but I was nervous, but I did it. And I found the people I was most terrified of at that group actually were full of a lot of love. And when I talked to them one-on-one, they taught me a lot of things. And I can remember there, I thought I was going to be the last newcomer in that meeting. And there were some other guys that came along, and I can remember the God stuff kind of got me a little bit. I wasn't hot on God. I mean, I didn't come here to find God. I just wanted to try and manage this drinking a little bit, and I was there under the requirement of a treatment center. And I can remember asking questions about that. And it was funny because I can remember telling Jack, I'm having a little bit of a problem with this God idea. And I can remember him saying, oh, for Christ's sakes, Rick, think of the trouble he's had with you. And, I remember another kid we were kind of after the meeting one day, and he goes, how do you find God? Where do you find God? And I could remember him saying, he's over there in the corner. And everybody looked in the corner to see where God was. And, he said, you'll get your ass backed up in that corner so bad one day you'll find God. And I thought, oh, this is kind of a strange idea. And, I remember on Sundays it was a meeting for home group members only, and I remember getting there early one Sunday, and I had a key, and I made the fire, and Paris lit into me like crazy for making the fire on his day to make the fire. But I got talking to him, and I asked him about meditation. I was kind of nervous around him because he was like an older, tough guy. Everybody's birthday he'd tell me, next year sucks. They didn't say exactly like that. He got to talking to me about prayer and meditation, and it was the last guy I thought that would ever talk to me about that. And I can remember real early in sobriety, my first contact with a loving, merciful God that absolutely did not have my permission to come into my life. Here I am now, I'm not drinking, I'm over the DTs, I'm going to these meetings, I'm involved with this treatment center 4 nights a week, and my wife says, remember you promised Shannon to finish off that closet and build that room for her upstairs? You've never done that. She's been waiting for that for like 4 or 5 years. My little girl was 8 years old when I got here, and she had this little tiny room in the top of this little house that we had been living in. And I said, oh, yeah. And, my sobriety date is the end of June. This was like early August. It was hotter than the hinges of hell up in that little room, I got to tell you. But I had agreed that I was going to do this, so I got up there, and it was just, this unfinished room with wires and stuff in it, and I am not a carpenter, I have to tell you. I am not a handy guy at all. We went out and bought the ugliest white paneling you could think of, and, some light switches and stuff, and I started building this room, and this talk about God was freaking me out, and my sponsor, Jack, made me promise that I couldn't complain about any of this to my family. I couldn't make a big fuss over it. that I had to do this for my daughter. I mean, when I first came into the program, I remember shaking and quaking. I'm going to lose my family. I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose. He said, would you shut up? He finally shook me one day. Shut the hell up. You deserve to lose them. Get busy on this recovery and quit crying like a baby. And so, you know, he made me make these promises. I can't complain. I can't swear in front of them. I can't give them a hard time. My job now, you know, 3 weeks after I was complaining I was going to lose him, I was like, hell with him, I'm leaving. I remember he asked me one day, when I was so worried about losing my job, he says, well, you know, what's the worst job you ever had? He said, I said, well, I washed dishes one time in a restaurant. He goes, great, you can do that. He goes, do you have an education? I go, well, yeah, I have a couple college degrees. He goes, wonderful, you can be the busboy. You don't have to be the dishwasher. He goes, so that's the worst it's ever going to get for you. Now shut up and let's get into this program. So, you know, I'm promising I'm going to do this stuff, and I'm up there, and there's God, and I'm resentful at God is the way I'm talking to him. I'm like, okay, God, you know, God, and I'm up there, and I've got a big circular saw on this flimsy paneling, and it's going, I'm trying to cut it, and it's cutting crooked, and a friend of mine tells me, you don't even need that, you know, after I've got this screwing around with it, for, you know, just take a carpet knife and cut it, snap it, put it, you know, I didn't know that. And everything I'm seeing in this room, I'm very hateful about it. Nothing matches. The grain on the paneling doesn't match. The nails are sticking out. The light switches are an inch away from the wall. I just want to get this damn thing over, and I keep cussing at God. God, what's in it for me? What is in it for me? I can remember this like it was yesterday. And, you know, then my wife shows up with this desk that she bought in a box. And I couldn't build it. I had to bring the box into the room because the room was so small. And I had to build it in this room. The instructions were all in Korean or Chinese. I had parts left over. Nothing. I'd have to take it apart after I got it together because I had it together wrong. Put it together again. I was really ticked off. We've got this stupid carpeting down there that didn't match nothing. And finally, I was done with this damn room. And I can remember what's in it for me. What's in it for me? What's in it for me? I'm just so self-centered. But I couldn't complain about it. And I'm sweating like a banshee up there all the time, and I'm getting thirsty on this deal, and I am so glad it's over. And I come home from work thinking, great, I don't have to work in that friggin' room today. It's hotter than hell up there. I don't have to go up there. And it's real quiet. Now, my kids were known to run around and fight like hell. I don't know where they learned that. But it was real quiet. And that was the very beginnings of rap music back then. And I couldn't stand that. And they'd have this stuff going on and they were fighting. And I mean, I hated this. And I'd come home and it was quiet. And I remember going back into the kitchen and asking my wife, going, where's the kids? What's going on? She goes, shh, you won't believe this. You should tiptoe upstairs and see what's going on. And so I kind of get up about halfway up the stairs and I peek in there and my son, who is 10, is sitting at this desk coloring and just being nice. And my daughter had this little girl that lived in back of us, and our backyards joined each other with her, and she's in this room, and I can hear her talking to the girl, and she goes, isn't this the coolest room in the entire world? My dad built this room for me. Don't I have the neatest dad? And right then I just fell down. I couldn't stand up. I thought, what's in it for me? What is in it for me? And it was like the hand of this loving God reached down and pierced right through my denial and gave me a moment of grace where I was able to acknowledge that to do something for that little girl, which was so unnatural for me, she in that moment was able to forgive, to love, and compliment the guy who'd been beating up her mom, who'd been scaring the hell out of her and not even coming home at night. That freaked me out. That made me willing to start seeking, what the heck is this? You know, what is this power all about? Now I'm like, okay, God, you got my attention here now. I want some of that. That's what I want. And I started being attracted to people that had that. And, you know, through the course of sobriety, you know, at first I used that power and I used that experience and others like it as kind of things get going. I mean, if my ass is on fire, I'm looking for the hose. You know, I want to put the fire out. And that was my relationship with God in the beginning. And then I found out that, you know what, I've come to believe that the only thing God wants alcoholics to do, my buddy Paul convinced me of this, is just accept the help that he's got there for us. And I've learned that the reason I feel so good around alcoholics, and in particular, I mean, our literature tells us, practical experience tells us that when everything else fails, now that tells me everything else is going to fail. The fellowship's going to fail me. The steps probably aren't going to work out the way I want them to. You know, things probably aren't going to go according to my expectations. But when everything else goes wrong, that intensive work with another alcoholic will save the day. The reason I feel so good when I'm with you is not because I love you, but once again, it's like my buddy Paul tells me, it's because of what I get to be when I'm with you. Because when I trust you, and when you trust me, see, I didn't come in here a trustworthy guy in my own eyes, and I wasn't trusting you. But trust is an action of love. And like Dr. Bob says, you boil our program down to its simplest ingredients. It's a program of love and service. And I believe they're the same thing. Love is a verb, service. It's an action word. We take actions of service. We're loving each other. When I'm trusting you and you're trusting me, I feel loved. And that's what I was looking for the whole time. I just wanted to be loved. All those old belief systems about my needs are not important, my life doesn't matter, I'm not lovable, nobody cares about me. I walked through my whole life grabbing information from my life that supported that belief system. It wasn't until a guy said, hey, you know that stepfather that dressed you up funny? This was a sponsor. This was my second sponsor. I go, yeah. Could you believe that there might be another explanation behind that? I said, yeah, like what? He took away my favorites. He took away the things I want. You know, he made me do that. He said, do you suppose he loved your mom? Well, yeah. Do you suppose that he loved her enough and he had the capability to dress these three little kids that looked like little ragamuffins in the finest clothing that was available then? And I thought, that was again, whoa. I had resented that guy for that my whole life. He loved my mother enough to take her children in, dress them up, and try and get them to go to town with him, you know? And I hated him for it. So I started looking at this kind of stuff, and I started developing a relationship with this power, and I started experimenting with prayer. The grotto, I heard Blair talk about experimenting with prayer. I thought Blair was a minister when I got there. He wore a sport coat and a tie one day, and I thought, that guy, and I remember telling somebody, they're talking about experimenting with prayer. I go, it's a preacher out there, you know, he had a coat and tie on. Turned out he's just a real estate guy who had a coat and tie on. But I didn't know. And, you know, what has happened along the way has been phenomenal to kind of bring you through. I mean, I was four to 5 years sober, and we got an anonymous phone call one day at our house, and it was a lady on the other end of the phone talking to my wife, and she says, this is a concerned parent. I'm a concerned parent from XYZ school where your kid goes to school, and I just want to tell you your son's very popular. And my wife goes, why, thank you. And she goes, well, let me tell you why he's popular. He's got fake IDs, bringing booze to all the parties. He's involved in a marijuana growing operation, and he is extremely popular. And if you don't get involved with what he's doing right now, chances are he's going to be in big trouble. That freaked us out because he had seen me go through all of this stuff, beating up his mom, doing all this stuff. And I taught him some good lessons. I taught him to be a great liar. I taught him to cheat and steal. With all of my behavior, I had taught him this stuff. And he was putting it to good use. I was so freaked out about this that I can remember talking to my sponsor about it. And he says, you know, he asked me, have you been praying about it? And I said, well, you know, I haven't tried that. Better get experiment with prayer, like old Blair said. So I start putting a little neology in on it. And what comes into my mind when I allow God to come into my heart is that that boy needs some information, but it probably can't come from me. And it's like 2 or 3 days later, I'm like, I love this one prayer that I use. It's like, dear God, take the burden from me. You know, relieve me of the need to feel like I have to be your assistant in this, you know. I'm willing to accept whatever the consequence. I'm surrendering. I'm saying, relieve me of the bondage of me, that I can better fix myself, suit myself to do your will. And what happens is, a couple days later, my wife says, hey, I met this criminal defense attorney at school. They were there for this lawsuit. She wants to talk with Ricky about the things he's been doing that are criminally wrong. I go, oh, there's the other guy, there's the other information. And then a psychologist that we happened to be in therapy with, we were in therapy, says, hey, I know of a program at the Oregon State Penitentiary where you can take your son, and these guys that have been in terrible trouble talk about how they started where he is. So I get to go through this stuff with my son just as somebody that's there with him. We became pals going through this together. And then I learned in that prison where I thought, hey, I can't be help the guys in jail because I've never been arrested. I learned that there's no difference between me and those guys, just that I never got caught. Those guys all got caught. I just never got caught. Those guys gave freely and lovingly to my son and imparted information to him that saved his life. And I hit my knees with those guys and prayed with those guys and loved those guys and thanked those guys with all my heart because they did what I could not do for that kid for free. They didn't get extra cookies. They didn't get time off their sentence. They didn't get anything for doing this. It's their way of setting things right with their creator for unfortunate circumstances earlier in their life. I had a situation where I was accused of sexually molesting a young girl our family loved deeply when I was about 8 years sober, actually about 7 years sober. I can remember coming home for dinner one night and my wife says, you know, when you're in those alcoholic blackouts, could something terrible happen? Could you have perhaps, when we were camping or something back then, have molested someone? I'm like, what? I mean, that definitely ruins your appetite for dinner when that comes up as the topic. And I freaked out really bad on this one. And I can remember, I was lucky because it was the middle of summer. My family's in the ice business. I was working really hard. They needed somebody to haul all this ice up to Timberline Lodge, and I'm volunteering because it's heavy, and I know I'm going to work, and I'm just hating the thought of people thinking of me. I'm thinking, what are they thinking of me? What are they thinking of me? What are they thinking of me? Once again, self-centered behavior. But on that drive up there, I am calling out to God, God, what is this? How is this? What's the lesson in this? I don't understand this. And, you know, by the time I get up there, I'm working my tail off, putting this away. And on the way back down, it all of a sudden hits that little girl is screaming out for help. It's not about me. It doesn't matter what other people think of me. What matters is what kind of help can this little girl get and where is this really coming from? Later on, it turns out that she's taken this steroid for acne called Accutane. She's drinking and trying ecstasy on top of that. And on this Accutane, you have to get pregnancy tests. She's going in every 60 days to get tested, and she's telling her friends, this guy's sexually molesting her. So she's at a lady's house about a month later, and my wife comes running in. Now I know this isn't true. I know it's not true. She's saying this stuff. We got to help these people, take her to the psych ward, you know. That's a little bit of a tip for anger when you get accused of something like that. You know, it was just a few years ago that I was with this little girl, and we're talking, and she looks at me and says, we both know how it is to be accused of something wrong and how it feels, don't we? And I got to look at her and say, yeah, we do. We really do. You know, last few years to bring you current, I'm still married to the same woman. You know, paying attention to the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts of this program is the only place where huge miracles have happened in my life. My wife has found the capacity to forgive me for what she's doing. We've been married, we celebrated our 30th anniversary last year, and I get a lot of people would come up to me and say, Rick, you've been in this relationship for such a long time. I've had this problem. I'm going, hey, wait a minute. I'm the guy that tears them up, you know. She's the one you ought to be talking to. But I would give advice. You know, what's that all about? Look at me, I know something, you know. I really don't know a whole lot about them, but I would tell people stuff like, well, you know, after the bloom comes off the rose, or, you know, after a while, this becomes a lot of work, you know. And I leave out the part, like, especially when you're smacking them, you know. I leave that out. And they think, oh, okay, you know. I had no business giving that advice. But I found myself, my wife's father this last year, just about a year ago, developed pancreatic cancer and died in a very short period of time, a very cruel and brutal death. And I was fortunate enough to have made amends to him. I hated him at one time. He did not have a lot of love for me at one time, oddly enough, possibly. Maybe the way I treated his daughter might have had something to do with that. And also, the fact that I was an in-law in a family business that was once worth nothing, now is worth a lot, wanting me to earn my way along with his children because we've been together for a long time. When he got sick I found myself stopping at his house every day at the end of the day, asking him if he needed anything, helping him when his feet were sore, helping massage and wash his feet. I don't massage and wash people's feet, you know, doing that for him. Taking those, when I was sweeping those needles off the pathway leading into the grotto, and I was making that fire and making the coffee and loving, trusting you and feeling loved, I had no idea that the overflow from that would be that I would be able to take loving actions. And in my wife's situation in that, she had a very, very, very difficult time as the oldest child losing her father, and I made it a real purposeful intent in my life to try and make her life easier, to try and do things with her, to serve her family, to try and be of use, to be of service in that family situation. My wife takes a group of kids to New York City for a week. She's a school teacher, and I'm on the way to pick her up at the airport at 11 o'clock at night, which I may have bitched about this in the past. 11 o'clock, come on, can't you take her kid? You know, but I'm on the way to the airport, and I find myself excited to see her as if it was the first time I met her at that dance. I get this ticklish kind of feeling, and I'm going, what in the heck is this? And then I see her at the airport, and she, it's like it's a new vision, you know? We come running up to each other. We have actually been able to rekindle and fall in love with each other again in a way that is unbelievable. She means everything to me. You know, I'll tell you how self-centered I am. Her name is Virginia. When I first met her, all her friends called her Jenny. I'm like, I don't like that. I don't like that name. That sounds like some kind of old barnyard animal. Like the Jenny out in the barn. I'm going to call you Verge. She hated that. I called her Verge for 20 years. You know, 20 years. Verge. You know, she just hated that. You know, now, it was about 5 years ago, I thought, yeah, I'm kind of slow on this. I'm thinking, you know, maybe I'll call her the name she likes to be called, you know. So now when I leave in the morning, I kind of tickle her feet at about 6 o'clock and say, little Jenny, time to wake up. And she smiles, you know. I think, God, I've been missing this. This is what I've been missing. I can start the coffee and call, just to call her the name that all of her friends have called her. You know, what a retard I am. A couple of years ago, my son, they told us, this kid's got everything in common with him as everybody on death row. Don't plan on him graduating from high school. He's definitely not going to college. Well, he had one of his best friends die about 5 years ago. Didn't wake up after falling asleep that night. No drugs or alcohol involved. Just didn't wake up. Who does he call? He called me. He wanted to call me to talk to me about one of the deepest losses that he had. What a privilege for my son to call me instead of his mother as a result of this program. My daughter decides that she's had problems all her life with these men. She's gay. Who does she tell about that? She calls her dad to tell him, you know what, I know that you understand this more than mom, and I want to talk to you about it and find out what you think might be the best way to handle that. I get to tell my daughter, hey, you're my daughter. I love you no matter what. If this is the decision that you make and this is the life that you live, that's your decision. I'm going to love you. You can, you know, I don't care what your lifestyle is, you know. I do care. And don't get me wrong. I don't have to believe the way you believe, but my love for you is never going to change. And I love you unbelievably. I would never have been able to tell that to my daughter without the gifts of this program. We are so close today, it's unbelievable. She calls me all the time. I met her partner this last Christmas, came over. I love her as much as my daughter. It's incredible. She's a wonderful young lady. You know, my son graduated. He did graduate from college. You know, my wife used to have these dreams. Wouldn't it be nice to live in a new house? Like, are you friggin' retarded? You know what a new house was going to cost me? You know, wouldn't it be nice if our kids could go to college? Are you out of your mind? You know what college cost? You know, I stomped all over her dreams. It ended up, we were, sobriety, once again, we ended up, circumstances led to us getting a new house while I'm doing the steps with other alcoholics. Circumstances led to these kids getting a car, and even the kid that was a criminal and that was no good and that was in trouble graduated from college. I asked him, what is it that you want to do? Oftentimes kids graduate from college, they have plans, they want to go and do things. And he says, I already know. I'm going to hike the Appalachian Trail. I'm going to start in Georgia, and I'm going to end in Maine. I'm going to hike the entire East Coast of the United States. My alcoholic mind says, you little fart, don't you even want to go camping first and see if you even like it? What a cruel, sarcastic thing that is to say. I didn't say that. What I said was, you're graduating in December. You don't leave until May. Why don't we talk about it while we work together on the weekends, and I can see how you plan this. We became such good friends over the planning of this trip, and he went and he made the trip. The beautiful thing about it, he came back from that trip cut out of a new piece of cloth. He's a different kid. He called me along the way when he had signals on his phone to talk to me about things like, how do you talk to God when you're really hurting? What kind of a question is that from a young kid hiking? I'm like, well, you just talk to him. You know, you just talk to God. He goes, I got a sprained ankle. I don't like thinking about it. Then he calls me back and goes, you know what? I walked and I thought about God and my ankle didn't hurt and I made it. You know? And he said, the one thing I want to do, Dad, I want to get to the end of that trip. I want to stand up on the sign at the summit of Mount Katahdin with a sign that says, Happy Birthday, Dad, I made it. His plan was to get there on October 14th, finish the hike, and hold that sign up for me at the end of that trail. This is the kid that ran away from me, you know. I'm telling you, there are a million fantastic things that have come to pass for me as a result of taking an experiment with prayer, trying to do something for my family. The first time I stood up and said, I'm going into the other room, can I get something for somebody? They about fell over. They couldn't believe it. So getting out of myself, all the lessons, all the things I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, has given me a life beyond my wildest expectations. And I firmly believe that I'm just beginning in this program at 15 years sober. I have just begun to make contact consciously with the power that I'm set free. I do not have to worry what's going to happen to me. I just got to release myself, open my heart and everything I've got to this power, do everything I can for you. The guys that I'm privileged to work with help me by allowing me to work with them. I mean, we got to surrender to win here, you know. I used to think the word surrender was weak. It was give up, you know. And I looked it up in the dictionary, it says to join the winning side. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm surrendering. So today I give up. I mean, the book tells me all my problems. This power will solve all my problems. It solved my finance problem, my marriage problem, my parenting problem, my employer and employee problem, every problem of my life. When I'm thinking, well, I'm going to try and experiment with this. Everything I give to that power, the creative intelligence that underlies the totality of everything in the entire universe, that's a huge power. If you told me I could have a personal relationship with that, I thought you're smoking something. But I get to do that today. So today I get to begin to do that. And the way I found it, it's like my little girl said one time, it's a monkey see, monkey do program. You know, Dad. You know, it's like the parents teach the kids. This program is a monkey see, monkey do program, but be careful because there's monkeys running around here, don't even eat bananas. There's crazy monkeys in this program. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, be careful of the monkeys you hang around with here because you want to find out the good monkeys and you want to eat the bananas that they're eating. I'll tell you one quick little story before I'm done here. You know, our book also tells us to be quick to take advantage of what religious people have to offer us. And I find myself sitting in a Catholic church one day, and I had heard the best description of one day at a time while I was sitting there. This pilot is flying a gigantic airplane full of people across the universe somewhere, and they lose all the hydraulics in this plane, and they realize they're going to crash into the mountain. And he says to the co-pilot, what are we going to do here? We got all these people on here. We have no way of controlling this jet. We got to tell these people that they're going to die. And how much time do we give? How do we tell them? And the co-pilot says, I don't want to give them any more than 5 minutes. They're going to go absolutely stark and make them crazy. We may crash earlier than hitting the mountain. And who knows, we may even have a chance we hit the mountain. So they give all these people 5 minutes notice, and sure enough, they crash and everybody's killed. They're digging through the rubble and they find this guy's billfold and they open it up and there's a note in there and it says, to the kids, be good, help your mother, do the best you can. And to his loving wife, it says, who would have thought that macaroni and cheese dinner we had last night would have been our last meal together? You know, all we have is one day at a time here, you know. And when I stay in the present, I think of the great football coach Lou Holtz when he says, you guys want to win? And his team, you know, all these guys at Notre Dame. He goes, win stands for what's important now. What's important now? They may have missed that previous assignment and that guy ran for a touchdown, but there's another play coming. They got to get up, dust themselves off, and try their best again. He says, now, if you've won, you spell that backwards, that's the word N-O-W. That's now. You've stayed in the now. Stay in the present. All we have is right now. Our book tells us there's one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him where? Now. Find him now. Not tomorrow, not yesterday, not maybe. He is right here with us right now. And I'm telling you, if you have trouble with the God idea, like my old first sponsor said, think of the trouble he's having with you. Anyway, I could go on for hours. My time's up here. Thank all of you for being here. It's been great to be with you. I love each and every one of you. I'd say God bless you, but he already did because you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, it could be worse off. It could be in an Al-Anon meeting. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.